Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
I'm Hemant Mehta.
And I'm Jessica Blumke.
And you're listening to the podcast for FriendlyAtheist.com. You can now listen to all of our episodes and see show notes at FriendlyAtheistPodcast.com.
I am here at the American Atheist Convention in Memphis, Tennessee, and I'm joined now by Matt Dillahunty. Thank you for coming in.
Yay, thanks.
So I actually am really excited to interview. I've been stalking you and your wife all weekend, trying to get you in the boardroom, because actually I, not to start this interview off by talking about me, which, you know, here we go. I was an atheist in college, but after starting to read the Friendly Atheist blog in 2011, that kind of led me to the Nonprofits podcast and the Godless Bitches podcast, and that was sort of when I took the plunge into, like, being obsessed with atheism and reading all about it. So it's, I don't know, like, that podcast really just hit home because it was my first experience that, like, I didn't grow up in a place where I saw the dangers of religion necessarily. Right. And it was the first time, like, hearing these stories of, like, how dangerous religion actually is. So thank you.
Thank you. I'm always, you know, I run around. I get to do what I love to do now.
Yeah.
And people will come up and say, oh, thanks so much. The work that you guys have done on the show or the debates and the podcast, they've been very helpful. And that's great.
Yeah.
And the one thing I always tell people, because occasionally somebody's like, oh, you changed my life. And I'm like, no, you changed your life. I'm just a guy who likes to talk a lot. And you had to be willing to listen and being open to changing your
and
mind.
And seek it out and all that good stuff. So I know you guys, excuse me, what's the call-in show that you guys do on Sundays?
The Atheist Experience.
The Atheist Experience.
And that one's on cable, on public access, at least for now.
Yeah.
And then streams live to the world.
Yeah, and so you have people calling. Do you tend to get more Christians or more atheists who just want to talk to somebody?
So early on, so the show's been on for like 18 years, and I've been hosting it for 10. When I first started, we would get more theistic callers, and we got more callers from the Austin area because it was on cable.
Right.
And we started streaming it to the world, and all of a sudden the calls started shifting to where we were getting more and more calls from outside of Austin. Now it's rare that we get a call from within Austin as well.
Oh, interesting.
We do have 4 phone lines, and there was a point where, I think there were a couple weeks where we got no theistic callers at all, where it was just atheists calling in.
And do they just want to talk to somebody, or do they actually have questions, or are they just want a platform?
Some of them just wanted to say, you guys are awesome, we love the show. And I'm like, stop. Yeah, I appreciate that, but stop doing it, because you wouldn't love the show if it was just people calling in to say how much they love the show.
Send me an email, buddy.
Yeah, it's great. And I, you know, it's don't get me wrong, I love doing the show. I got no plans to quit. But with 4 phone lines, what we started doing was saying, we'll take calls from anybody.
Mm-hmm.
But we're keeping at least 1 line, and now I think it's 2 that are just open for theists.
Oh, okay.
And so if we get 2 atheists on lines like 1 and 2, then if another atheist calls in on 3, it's, you know, sorry, we're keeping these lines open for theists.
Yeah.
But quite often, you know, it's not like atheists are a hive mind that agree on everything. Mm-hmm. So the fact that someone happens to not believe in a God doesn't mean that they don't have something to call in about,
right,
to have a discussion or a debate that's worthwhile. So, the call screener is probably the most important person on the show.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, that's really interesting. So you grew up, were you religious growing up?
Crazy. Well, crazy is probably not the right word for it. I should probably scrub that from my vocabulary anyway. I was a fundamentalist Southern Baptist for at least 25 years or so. I remember walking down the aisle at the age of around five at a revival and accepting Jesus into my heart. And then in my teen years, I started to understand or have a better understanding of the religion, and I realized, holy cow, you know, how could I have understood this at five? I couldn't have, you know.
Right.
So clearly all this
now
time...
Now that I'm 14, I'm much more sophisticated.
Exactly. I'm 14 now. That means all these years I've thought I was saved and I wasn't, so I better do it now. And then I better do it again and again, because, you know, you get in this little cycle of you're not living right for God, and then you go and you... So that was... I was not forced... Well, I say I wasn't forced to go to church. I went to church voluntarily and eagerly for most of my teen years. My friends were there. We did a lot of good things, or what things that I thought were good. And I was there Sunday morning, Sunday night, Monday night visitation, Wednesday night church, Thursday night, I think, was youth group, and then occasional Fridays and Saturdays. The only time I was forced to go to church when I didn't want to was Sunday morning, and that's just because I'm not a morning person. It's not like, oh, I was ready to go to church, I just didn't want to get up.
I thought Sunday was the big one, or is that not?
That's why I was forced to go. If Sunday wasn't a big deal, they'd have just let me sleep. But, you know, people are like, oh, your parents forced you to do all this. No, actually, I think I went to church and did more stuff with the church than my parents did.
Oh, interesting.
Not that they wouldn't have. It's, you know, my dad had a job, you know.
And so when did you kind of start having doubts about it?
So I joined the Navy because, like many of the kids in my youth group, I thought that God wanted me to be a preacher, and I was terrified of public speaking, which is incredibly ironic, because now I don't shut up. And I never get stage fright anymore. I mean, I was anxious about the show that I was doing last night because it's a bit different. But within like a minute of, you know, showtime, I was okay. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that wasn't the question. I was terrified of public speaking. I didn't want to be a preacher. Mm-hmm. So I left. I joined the Navy. I did 8 years in the military. And then I went and worked in the tech industry. I worked for Dell for a number of years. Mm-hmm. And I lost my job. And I lost my job because I was too good at it.
Whoops.
I basically worked myself out of a job. This is, you know, when you're working alongside people with degrees and experience and seniority and you don't have any, you work a little bit harder. And then it turns out I got all my work done early and just around the time they were deciding to have layoffs. And they're like, we don't have any work for you to do. And I was pissed. Uh-huh. And I said, I don't want anything to do with the tech industry. And I was definitely depressed. I don't think I suffer from chronic depression, but situational. When I'm unemployed, I'm not a good person, you know, to myself.
Yeah.
And I sat there and I thought, this is punishment. God wanted me to be a preacher. I rejected that. I rebelled. I went and did, you know, time in the military. I didn't care about God or church. I believed, but I just ran around and did what I wanted to do. And then I had my career in the tech industry, and I was so concerned with materialistic things and, you know, making a career that God decided he'd take it all away and put me back where he wanted me. And I said, okay, I give up. Uh-huh. I give up. God, if you want me to be a preacher, I'll do it. Uh-huh. And I spent about a year and a half in really serious prayer and study. And my uncle was a former missionary and medical doctor, and I talked to him about some stuff. And I had some minister friends that I interacted with. But my roommate at the time was an atheist. And we were best friends. We still are. And we had agreed to not talk about this because we wanted to stay friends.
Yeah.
And then I realized, if I'm going to get serious about God and I'm going to be the best Christian I can be, I can't get to heaven and have God say, why is this guy who you love like a brother in hell? Why didn't you do your job? So I set out to figure out how to convince an atheist, and that backfired spectacularly. He and I never even had a conversation. The first conversation we had about this, because I'm sitting here, I'm studying, I'm like, I've got to figure out a way so that Sean doesn't burn in hell. Uh-huh. You know, that was my goal. And I remember we were working at the same place, and we drove home from work one day, and I said, I think I'm kind of agnostic. And he goes, okay. That was it. And then shortly thereafter, I think I had about a week of identifying as an agnostic before I realized that, you know, that's not me. That's, and we don't have to go into the label stuff, but I was very quickly atheist. I was started writing stuff online, and he just kind of sat back and watched this process. And he's, don't be wrong, he's been an atheist for ages. He's not active in the community, but he fully supports, you know, me doing this. He knows that I love it. He congratulates me when I do stuff. But he's got his life to live. And I understand that, that what I do and the things that you do, they're not for everybody.
Right.
And I'm happy with people who quietly support from the sidelines as well. I would prefer that everybody be out and, look, we're here. We deliver your mail. We write your software. We replace your kidneys. There's no reason to hate us.
Right.
But it's not the world where everybody feels comfortable with it or even a need to do that.
Yeah, for sure. Do you ever deal with burnout in terms of, like, the atheist stuff that you're just, like, reading the same shit over and over and, like, I cannot read one more time about somebody talking about how women are submissive and the worst? Like, do you ever feel... Like, I used to get... When I blogged more, I don't blog as much on the site anymore, but I would just get fried on it.
I remember when I first started with the atheist community of Austin. I was writing things, and somebody said, "Oh, there's this TV show in town. You should check it out." Mm-hmm. And I was like, "Why would I want to watch a show with a bunch of people who agree with me?
Yes.
What good is that?" And I watched, and I loved it, and I loved the interaction, and I got involved, mm-hmm. and I started working with the show, and then very shortly I ended up as president of the ACA and the librarian and doing the Atheist Experience TV show every week and the nonprofits and as many other things as I could do. And one of the co-hosts on the show who'd been involved in this for a number of years said, "Don't take on too much. Mm-hmm. You're going to get burnout." Mm-hmm. I don't know what it is. I don't seem to get burnt out. I'm pretty good at... I'm busy.
Yeah.
But I'm pretty good at finding me time. Like, I've played a truckload of video games and watched lots of TV over the last 10 years, too, and held a full-time job and did the volunteer stuff. It's... I don't know. I'm passionate about it. One of the things that I try to keep in my mind is that, you know, we come to the convention and Silverman asks everybody, if this is your first convention, raise your hand. Uh-huh. And I'm always shocked by how many hands go up. I'm expecting to show up at a convention where there's like 10 hands that go up.
It's
like three-fourths of this is their first major convention ever.
Yeah.
And that really excites me, mm-hmm. and it reminds me. So when I do the TV show, I'm trying to remember, yes, I've heard this argument 1,000 times, but this is somebody's first time watching the show.
Yeah.
And when people ask me about debating, we did the workshop the other day, I said, you know, the most important things, figure out what your motivation for doing this is, mm-hmm. and if it's not because you care about other people in the world we live in, mm-hmm. stop, because I don't need your help anymore.
Yeah.
I legitimately give a damn about what kind of world I live in.
You don't want to just be like the smartest guy in the room. You want to...
Yeah. I mean, that's... I get that. And I get the frustration that a lot of people express. Mm-hmm. But I don't... At least so far, I haven't got to the point of serious burnout. Now, I have scaled back on some things. Like, I'm not president of the ACA anymore. That was partially... I decided not to run, because I had some concerns that I might be holding the group back, that I was doing so much that I wasn't doing anything for the ACA. So let's let other people get in and do stuff. Mm-hmm. And they're doing great. And, you know, I don't do nonprofits anymore. But I'm not on the TV show as much because I travel.
Yeah.
But I'm doing a lot of stuff, and I'm doing good stuff and stuff that I enjoy, and people seem to appreciate it. So I'll probably do this till I die, unless we fix the world before I die.
Here's hoping.
Yeah.
So do you find when people call in, when theists call into your show, do you think it's from a sincere place of, like, do you find that you change people's minds ever?
So it's incredibly rare to change somebody's mind over the course of a single call.
Sure.
And usually when that happens, I suspect that we've got a prank caller. And we get a lot of those. Mm. And it used to irritate me, but I don't mind so much. I'd rather we didn't, you know, get the pose calling in to pretend to be. The thing is, you can't tell the difference. And somebody out there believes what that person believes.
Yeah.
And what we know about the interactions is that if you see someone who shares your views humiliated or make a fool of themselves and represent it poorly, that causes you to perhaps do some extra work. And the times that I know that people's minds have been changed, one of the most, strong results is they'll seek to prove me wrong. They'll mm-hmm. stop calling in and they'll say, oh, this guy's wrong and I'm going to prove it. And yeah. they'll set out to put together a compelling argument. And they end up changing their own mind. And yeah. I'm a huge fan of the Socratic method. Ask questions, get mm-hmm. people to come to the realization on their own.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
To answer the actual question, you know, I've got over 10 years, there are thousands of emails from people who are like, oh, I used to be a Christian, a Hindu, a Muslim, mm-hmm. a Scientologist. Now I'm not. I used to identify as an agnostic. Now I don't. I didn't identify as a skeptic, and now I do. I mean, this is the people who think that this is futile. Why are you wasting your time talking to them? You are absolutely wrong. First of all, I didn't need to change anybody's mind to know they were wrong because right. my mind was changed.
Right.
So yeah. clearly people can change their mind. Mm-hmm. And one of my favorites was I did a debate in Amarillo, Texas. And this 12 or 13-year-old girl came up afterwards, and she said, my folks are atheists, but they let me go out and explore whatever I wanted. Mm-hmm. And so they've taken me to all these different religious events, and you know, I've heard a bunch of stuff from different sides, but because of the debate tonight, I'm an atheist. And I was like, I win. I'll do 20 years of shows to get one little girl to reason her way to reality.
That's really cool. So you do a lot of debates and things like that. Mm-hmm. Does it get frustrating? Do you feel like they're, especially if you're debating somebody who's being kind of intellectually dishonest, which I feel like is pretty common?
Yeah, it's, I'm reluctant, and unless I've got really good, strong evidence that they are in fact being deceptive. Mm-hmm. If it's just sort of cognitive dissonance, if it's mistakes in their thinking, then they're just human. And I look at them, they're a victim of being human just like the rest of us are. I absolutely love debates. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter to me how frustrating my opponent might be to other people as well. I try to have a good time. I try to be... I'm my own harshest critic, so I try to get better at it. And when I leave the show, I'm replaying the show in my head and saying, oh, you should have said this. Oh, you dumbass, you should have said this other thing.
Yeah, I do that too.
And then when I do a debate, I end up reviewing it. And now I'm actually, like, I did a debate here in Memphis a year ago with Seitan Bergenkate. So I lived the debate, which was pretty painful. I then watched it again to see how it came off. Then I watched it again with my wife. And then I did a series of four videos deconstructing the debate to show mistakes that we both made, because you can learn from anybody's mistakes. And now I'm completely done with that debate and with Cy. There are people who I will debate again, like I'm debating John Ferrer for, I think, the third time.
Oh, really?
In Tennessee sometime, I think November, early November. And I love John. I mean, you know, we disagree. Mm-hmm. But we can have a good conversation, and he's so far the only debate opponent who has actually changed my mind on a point during a debate.
Oh, really? What was it?
I had thought that I had cleverly come up with a solution to the is-ought problem, and John pointed out that I was actually smuggling in a hidden ought, and he was correct. And I said, you know, I think during the debate I said... okay, I think you might be right. I'll have to think about this some more. But afterwards, he was right.
Yeah.
And the thing is, acknowledging that I was wrong about something and changed my mind, good thing.
Mm-hmm.
Looks good.
Yeah.
It's what I try to encourage people to do. And it didn't in any way affect which one of us was correct or had a better argument for whether or not a God exists.
Mm-hmm.
This was a secondary issue.
Yeah.
And people are like, oh, my gosh, you know, if you're wrong and they're right about X, you've just, like, lost the debate, because then it shows that they're smarter than you. No, not quite. It shows that the two of us came to different conclusions, or that I might have made a mistake, and that I'm willing to own up to that mistake.
Yeah.
It's not like God became real just because I didn't solve a problem in philosophy.
You know? So, a year and a half ago now when Bill Nye debated the guy with the giant jacket whose name is escaping.
Ken Ham.
Ken Ham.
He's got a book.
Oh, does he?
Yeah, the Bible.
Oh. So he got, Nye got a lot of criticism that, like, why would you engage this guy? It's not, what do you say to that?
So I was probably one of, so I was opposed to him doing this.
Oh, okay.
I don't want, well, first of all, Bill isn't a scientist, so I was more okay with it than I would have been if it was like Dawkins, because I don't want scientists engaging creationists.
Yeah.
This is not an issue that is worthy of scholarly debate.
Right.
I'd rather have scientists teaching people science and doing science.
Mm-hmm.
Bill was probably the best choice for it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought he did a good job. As I watched the debate, I watched it upstairs. My wife was downstairs, and she heard me scream because I, as a debater, there were a couple of critical mistakes that he made that I expected Ken Ham to capitalize on.
Uh-huh.
It turns out Ken Ham is just like the world's worst debater and did not capitalize on any of those, and so it worked out well. But my objections at the beginning was, no matter what happens with this debate, Ken Ham wins. Because if it looks to the public like he won the debate,
mm-hmm.
then he gets to go to his base and say, see, this is what we need to do. We're winning. Now we need more money so that we can do this more.
Yeah.
And if it looks to the public like Ken lost the debate, he gets to go to his base and say, hey, they're winning. We need more money to fight them.
Yeah.
And this is a payday all the way around mm-hmm. for Ken Ham and his institute, which was in financial struggles. And I was right, as was everybody else who said that. They got quite a bit of money out of it. This debate may be the most watched debate in history outside of presidential debates.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there were multiple feeds with millions of people watching.
Yeah.
Now, in hindsight, despite the fact that they got money, and they'll probably still go bankrupt trying to build this ARC thing, I think, in hindsight, I'm fairly glad that it happened
uh-huh.
because a lot of people saw it and because the creationists came off so poorly during
yeah.
that debate. There was a debate I did on Christian radio in Minneapolis, St. Paul. They've had me on a couple times. And they said, oh, would you come on and debate Ray Comfort? I was like, sure.
Yeah.
You know, and Ray came on and said, I don't have any interest in proving that God exists. I'm just here because I love Matt and don't want him to go to hell. And so he didn't actually debate.
Yeah.
And didn't make points. And people are like, oh my gosh, aren't you upset? Wasn't that a big waste of time for you? No. Because I was on Drive Time Christian Radio in Minneapolis, St. Paul,
uh-huh.
where Christian moms and their Christian kids were driving through traffic listening, and their representative looked like a buffoon. And I looked like someone who was coming in there reasonable, coming in willing to have a discussion, and it didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll take that.
Do you think that the fact that you come from a religious background kind of lends more merit in the eyes of, like, Christians who you debate?
In some cases, yes. I mean, people ask me, don't you regret all those years that you spent? No, I don't, because mm-hmm. I couldn't do what I do now if I hadn't spent these years doing it.
Yeah.
And, you know, while I love, you know, Dawkins and Krauss and all these individuals who are really good communicators,
mm-hmm.
If you're standing in front of a group of fundamentalists, a church, I did three nights of debate in a church in San Antonio, a church of Christ, and you pick an atheist to stand up there and have this debate in a church,
yeah.
As much as I like those guys, I'm going to do better than they are
mm-hmm.
because it's too easy for these individuals in the church who have been fed misinformation, who don't understand science, to just write them off as these are the intellectual elite. These are the people who have, you know, they don't understand
yeah.
our religion. They've never lived it. They don't know anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
And when I get up there, it's much harder for many of them to do it. Now, some of them can write me off as, oh, well, you were part of the wrong religion, or you were never really saved.
Or but you didn't believe properly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But what they can't say is, you don't know the Bible,
because
mm-hmm. I do, and better than most of them. They can't say, I've never met an atheist who was able to defend their position.
Mm-hmm.
I can still put on my kind of Christian thinking cap a little bit.
Yeah.
And that's useful, but as somebody who lived this,
mm-hmm.
I think it resonates. I'm kind of the, I'm under-credentialed and And I don't have the vocabulary of somebody like Hitchens, because who does?
Right.
So my entire purpose right now is to kind of take the complex concepts within philosophy and theology and distill them down so that almost everybody can understand them. Uh-huh. And even some of the best science communicators who can do that with science concepts fail at that when they get into religion, because they're dismissive of the philosophy, or they're, you know, oh, this is so obviously wrong. Why would I need to explain how absurd Pascal's wager is?
Right, yeah. Are you of the ilk? Do you want to see religion completely go away?
Yes.
Or, yeah?
I don't think it's going to happen.
Right.
I view religion as kind of like a byproduct of the way our brains work. Mm-hmm. In a bunch of complicated ways. But I don't think we're ever going to be perfect thinkers. I think we're just going to get better and better.
Yeah.
And what I see is, hopefully, religions... We know religions change. Mm-hmm. There are tons of dead religions, and I think the ones we have today will be dead, and there will be new religions that take their place. Mm-hmm. And generally what we're going to see is, I think, once the battles... So the battle lines... are going to get to the point where there are the extreme literalists, fundamentalists, and then everybody else is in this liberal, moderate, you know... I think we're going to lose the moderates. They're just going to go away.
Yeah.
And so there's going to be a greater divide. And ultimately, I think the current religions, Christianity, Islam, all Scientology, whatever, will either completely fade away, or they'll become roughly like the flat earthers. There's almost none of them, but they're still out there. I made a mistake on the show one time of saying, you know, nobody believes in Thor anymore. And, of course, I hear from someone who says that they do believe in Thor and those gods.
Really?
Yeah, like one person and two of their friends. I don't know. but I see it going that way. And I see it being replaced by the sort of woo stuff, the pseudoscience stuff. The, you know, maybe, hopefully we won't be stuck with, like, crystal healing and reflexology forever.
Yeah.
But it'll be something similar. It'll be some kind of watered down, feel good. My bigger goal is to make sure that whether religions survive or not, even after the change, that they don't have the power base to affect public policy and to dictate how everybody else can live their lives.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I'm kind of the mindset, like, I don't really give a shit what people want to believe, but my thing has always been the separation of church and state thing. And I find that to be appalling and frustrating, and... I was really into writing the blog a lot during the 2012 election. Mm-hmm. And I think that's when I started to get fried, because it was like the legitimate rape shit was going on and all of that. And it's just like, it's infuriating.
Yes. And it's, you know, the separation of religion and government. I mean, that's... So one of the things is that atheism doesn't have any tenets. There's no dogma. There's no requirement that you believe something. There's no pope of atheism.
Yeah.
And so you could be an atheist and not support church-state separation. I think there are atheists like S.E. Cupp who fall into that category.
Yeah.
And yet almost every atheist organization on the planet supports separation of religion and government, church-state separation. And you can start adding to that without creating a litmus test for atheism. You can add in things. Nobody complained when the Atheist Community of Austin did a blood drive or collected food for the homeless or even made our position statements. I mean, we support church separation, and we think there are positions that are derived from that on behalf of church separation. And it was fine.
Mm-hmm. So you were just in Australia, is that right?
Yeah, for 20 days. It was awesome.
Yeah, what? Tell me all about it.
So Aaron Ra and Seth Andrews, the Thinking Atheist podcast, I keep tapping your mic.
That's all right. The
three of us kind of got together a couple years ago and as a bit of a joke, it's not really a joke, we were serious about it, but we called ourselves the Unholy Trinity.
Yeah.
And we did a tour of a few cities, and immediately people were like, oh, how can we get you guys to come out and do this? And it's really good. Inevitably, though, I mean, it's still just... three middle-aged white guys. And so I think this Australia tour is probably the end of the Unholy Trinity in its current incarnation, except we're getting together in Vancouver at Imagine No Religion 5.
Nice.
And that will probably, because I don't I love those guys like brothers, and we do well together. But I don't need to speak at everything, and the three of us don't always need to speak at everything. Yeah. Anyway, Australia was, Arne and I flew down and went to Auckland, New Zealand, just the two of us, and did a talk there, met up with the local groups. Then the three of us did the tour for Sydney, Brisbane, and Melbourne. And then Seth and his family flew home, and then Arne and I went and flew all the way across to West Australia to Perth.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
And as soon as we added Perth, the people in Adelaide started sending me hate mail saying, hey, we're the city of churches. Why won't you come here? And I'm like, oh, my gosh. Okay, I'll try to come back, and I'll put Adelaide at the top of the list. But it was a great time. We had some great venues, amazing people. The religion and government issue there is a little bit different, and I think probably the thing they're facing most is some apathy and probably not legal restrictions that are properly set up to protect separation of religion and government. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I mean, apart from everything in Australia being out to kill you and the fact that I almost lost a hand and got bit by a spider and had a snake fall out of a tree.
What, really?
It was like the best trip ever. I got to hang out with quokkas and koalas and kangaroos and lots of amazing people.
Wait, I'm still thinking, a snake fell out of a tree?
Yeah, I was at Australia Zoo, which is someplace I've wanted to go forever. I was a huge Steve Irwin fan, and I've raised snakes for years. And I'm walking along the path, and a little brown tree snake, not venomous, fell out of a tree about 10 meters up and landed splat on the pavement.
Oh, my God.
And then propped up and looked around and then scurried off into the... And I got part of it on video. It was fun.
But oh, geez.
That was the minor one. I got bit by a little spider, had allergic reaction. I grabbed a stage door in Sydney right before I went on stage to pull it close. And it was huge. It was like 20 foot tall by 25 foot. And I grabbed the backside of it. And there's a shear point between the door and a brick wall. And my hand got in there and the door's got a lot of momentum built up. I barely got a foot and my other hand there to stop it. My wrist was swollen up for a couple, 3 days. And it was ironic because I got up on stage and I did a one-man play kind of as God, starting with Genesis, and everything keeps failing for him and going wrong. And it ends with him seeing me and like, you know, Dylan, he's down there mocking me. I'm going to smite you. And I was like, oh, if I'd have lost my hand right before I went on stage, that would have been pretty ironic. But evidently his aim and effectiveness is just as bad in Australia as it is everywhere else.
It's so funny. Well, last night I didn't know you did magic and mentalism, mm-hmm. too. You did that show last night. Do you have just a bag of tricks not magic tricks, but in terms of like, sometimes obviously you debate, sometimes you do the song and magic stuff.
Yeah. I'm kind of a hobbyist. I'm kind of the jack of all trades, master of none type thing. Mm-hmm. I tend to get obsessively into certain things. So like, you know, I ran the number one Counter-Strike team in the world for a while with my roommate, and I've done a lot of video game stuff, but I've been doing magic since I was about five. Uh-huh. And I wanted to be a professional magician when I was a teenager. I did shows at the church and the old folks' home and things like that. But if you're going to make a living at it, you've got to probably do kid shows.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I mentioned that last night during the show, but I was serious. It's just not me. I mean, I liked the close-up stuff better. I liked smart magic. And that's what I did for the most part. Mostly I'm a collector, and, you know, I'll have effects and tricks and stuff that I do for friends. But as I got more stage time, and I'm talking more about atheism, I also realized that, you know, I needed to spend time talking about skepticism and humanism as well.
Yeah.
And now I have more time for it. But I came up with, there was some talk somewhere where I knew a trick that I had done before would make the point perfectly. Mm, mm-hmm. So I started working more and more into it. And I have a number of friends who are, you know, professional magicians in the community and stuff. And I decided at a PostaCon, I guess, 2 years ago, mm-hmm. that I'd just do a magic show. And it went really well and people liked it. And so the American Atheist asked me if I would do something similar here. Mm-hmm. And I did. I was up till, I don't know, 4:30 in the morning reworking it, because it's a shallow stage with a really wide viewing angle. So it's hard to, I had to figure out how's everybody going to see everything. Uh-huh. But it's a bit of fun. I love doing it. I like it if it can teach something. Mm-hmm. And it's a way to entertain people, and I don't know. I guess it's also a way to show off. I'm not without ego. I have fun when I'm up there.
Yeah, for sure. I've always thought, I didn't know until I kind of got more into the community that, like, magic and skepticism really, like, run side by side.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's really interesting. And I mean, it makes sense now that I think about it. But I don't know, is it, why do you think that is, besides...
Well, it's far from perfect, but I mean, when you're in this field and you're seeing how people deceive themselves and how you can exploit that,
yeah,
you either end up being a magician mm-hmm. or some sort of con artist. And you know, the James Randi documentary on Honest Liar is out and. Various places.
Have you seen it?
I have not. It's going to be playing in Austin this Friday, and I was like, oh, I'm going to go see it then. But I'm at UT San Antonio on Friday.
I've actually seen it twice, and it is incredible.
I can't wait.
It's so good.
But when, you know, so you get to where you understand this stuff. I remember I did a card trick for some guys when I was in the Navy, mm-hmm. and one of them freaked out and said, you know, How can you stand to have the dark powers running through you to do that?
No.
And at the time I was a Christian and I was like, I don't want this guy thinking I'm demon possessed. Yeah. So I was like, no. Here's how I did it. I showed him the secret to the trick. And he said, that's not what you did the first time. So he was locked into this idea that even though I could have done it without the demonic powers, that I used demonic powers to do it. And even among magicians, you know, skepticism is not a cure-all. It's not a guarantee that you're going to think correctly. It's just an attempt to try to think correctly.
Right, right.
And so, like, you know, you look at somebody like Doug Henning, for a while, the most famous and popular magician in the U.S. in the mid-70s, mm-hmm. He's dead. And he's dead in part because he fell into the trap of some magical thinking with respect to transcendental meditation and didn't get proper treatment for his condition. Or at least that's my understanding of the story.
Right.
I guess I can't claim that because I didn't know him personally or what was going on. But there are Christian magicians. There are magicians who are into all sorts of supernatural stuff. And it's not that they don't know that some of this is fraudulent. It's that we often have it as there are people who hate magic and there are people who love magic.
Yeah.
And of the ones who love it, some of them are kind of really wishing for this supernatural world. You know? Oh, maybe it's why we like Harry Potter so much and things like that. And for whatever reason, some people's minds perhaps take it a bit too far.
Yeah.
But I think if you want to teach people how to think more critically, if you want to teach kids to appreciate skepticism, mm-hmm. magic is at least one of the ways that you can try to encourage that.
Yeah. I think I love that story about the card trick because in October, a buddy of mine, Johnny Zavant, who's a mentalist, mm-hmm. I do stand-up comedy, so I opened his show for him. And so I sit in the back of the house, and he came out and was like kind of glad I had a couple of the people who came in. And part of his shtick is he's like, these are tricks. It's practice. It's years and years of practice. You could do this if you like have the time.
If you spent 40 years.
Yeah, exactly. And this woman, after that whole thing, this woman, I watched this woman walk up to him and say, like, how long have you known about your special powers? And I mean, obviously we're all fallible, but I do not get when people, he told you what happened.
Yeah.
And you don't believe him or...
It's something, you know, there's lots of discussions, and I'm not going to pretending to be involved in them. There are things I've heard secondhand. Darren Brown is probably the best mentalist on the planet right now. Mm-hmm. Amazing guy. I actually did one of his effects at Apostacon. I'm looking forward to meeting him. But magicians have to, you know, in the process of explaining what they do, sort of, they lie.
Yeah.
You know, this is called patter, but I'm going to give you some explanation, and it's going to be garbage. You know, it's this and that, or it's vague. Well, he used to mention neuro-linguistic programming.
Uh-huh.
Part of what I do is, you know, NLP and things like that. And he's so good at what he does mm-hmm. that he was actually... There were people who were fans of NLP and promoters of NLP who would say, look, there's the proof that it works, Darren Brown.
Uh-huh.
And if you watch, I don't think he's mentioned NLP at all in the last 5 or 6 years.
Oh, interesting.
Because some people brought it, my understanding is some people brought it to his attention that by being so good at this and then crediting NLP, you're giving credence to something which is complete hogwash. You know, that to the extent that NLP works at all, it's nothing more than the process of convincing people mm-hmm. that you would normally use.
Yeah.
It's not like there's magic words that you string together. And, you know, we need to move this conversation in a new direction. And then all of a sudden, you know, you're getting laid. Which is what some of the NLP advocates are pushing.
There you go. Okay, you've been more than generous with your time. We can find your Patreon.
Yeah, it's patreon.com/atheistdebates. Okay. And it is me going through some of the classical arguments for the existence of God and how to think about them and how to respond. Also some kind of non-standard arguments. So the last video I posted was Y'all Just Want to Sin, which is something we'll hear from theists quite often. But in addition to that, I'm also doing interviews with other thinkers in the community because as much as I'd like for mine to be the only voice with regard to how to have these debates, I realize that I'm not always right, and it's good to hear from other people too. And the goal is not to create a whole bunch of little debate zombies that run out and have big formal debates and work from a script.
Mm-hmm.
It's to get people to a point where they actually understand the subject mm-hmm. so that they can have a conversation with anybody, family, friends, whatever, yeah. and that they're not working off a script, because that's what the other guys do. And the best thing you can do is throw them off the script.
Yeah. Cool. Well, thank you so much for your time.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Thanks for listening to the podcast for FriendlyAtheist.com. This episode was taped at Cinnamon Sound Studios in Aurora, Illinois, and the music was written and performed by Brad Chagdis. If you like what you're hearing, please consider making a contribution at patreon.com/Hemant. That's He-Man T. We appreciate your support. I'm Hemant Mehta.
And I'm Jessica Blumke. We hope you'll join us next time.